With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and thought leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve LeBall.
Hello, I'm Steve LeBall for another edition of Synapse Think Tank of the Air, and we're here with three thoughtful guests today, and we'll get started on that right away. We have, it's kind of like a reunion, a Synapse reunion, because all the people here have been to many of the Synapse events that we've had over the last year. And let's start with our co-founder of Synapse, Sarah Moe, who's a specialist with sleep health. And just give me just a brief intro of how you got to be where you are today.
Well, I went to school for polysomnography. I have my degree in sleep studies.
Polysomnography. Yeah. It sounds like a truth machine.
It's pretty close. Sleep can do wonders. So after getting my degree, I started practicing by working overnights, diagnosing sleep disorders and treating patients. After that, I became an adjunct professor where I taught sleep medicine. And it was at that time that I started my company, Sleep Health Specialists, to provide sleep health education to local businesses and corporations.
Can you teach sleep?
I can teach sleep.
Wow. I know some teachers that inadvertently teach sleep by just,
you know, it's not
presenting
as
a boring lecture.
It's the opposite of boring. It's fascinating. Sleep medicine is.
Oh, you put Rico Latino to sleep. We also have Rico Latino, who I've known for a long time, such a long time. And I first met you when you were working at a marketing agency, an ad agency, and you needed a Japanese translator or a Japanese talent, and you hired my wife.
That's right. Naomi was one of the key translators, transcreators, writers for Japan when I was doing a lot of international work.
Hmm.
My international work was mostly for Europe and Asia. And at the time, in the 90s, a lot of the Asia work was for Japan and a little bit Korea and China. Today, so the opposite is mostly China with a little Japan and Korea.
Well, China's taken over, I mean, pretty much. They're grabbing all they can get.
Yeah.
And you still do a lot of work in marketing?
Marketing communications, yeah, multicultural.
So, and you're from?
Argentina.
Okay. By way of?
By way of Brazil, Spain, England.
Wow. What an international traveler. And boy, our third guest here is Victor Price. Victor, wouldn't you want to go traveling sometime?
I always do.
Oh, okay.
I'm actually heading to Sweden and Berlin next week.
Wow.
So for 2 weeks.
Gosh.
But when you ask the question of how did I get here?
Yeah, how did you get here?
I got here through Miss Sarah Moe, the co-founder.
Oh, really?
Okay, yes. My husband and I moved here from New York about 4 years ago.
Hmm.
And in terms of international travel, I'm an Army brat. So I've lived overseas and abroad in Germany and Korea. I lived all around the States, and I still travel extensively as an adult and also as an Air Force veteran studying bioenvironmental engineering. And I had a small business doing image consulting, working with celebrities for videos, magazine covers, red carpets, Associated Whoa. Press. So my background is diverse as well. It's different taking that talent to different markets.
Hmm.
Sometimes they don't understand how that works. However, I love what I do. Hmm. So,
well, good, because I need an image makeover, or I need an image period to get going on that one. So we have a lot of work cut out for you, in other words.
That's fine.
So last summer, I was I gave a presentation at the Hispanic Marketing Conference, as did Rico Latino, and your topic was kind of going against the grain. It's like, you know, what they say in journalism, if a dog bites man, that's not news. But if a man bites dog, that's news, because that's different. Mm. And so you went against the flow and were kind of saying, let's not go overboard with all this influencer talk.
That's right. I basically quoted a lot of CMOs of large multicultural, global corporations, some of the largest brands in the world. Their CMOs were, and I quoted very fresh quotes by them. All of it happened last year, where there were a lot of people were in marketing and advertising were up in arms about the situation with influencer marketing, because they saw that a lot of followers, but then if an influencer has blank number of followers, say 500,000 or 5 million or 100,000,
by looking on their page,
you don't know, right? Yeah, they tell you that. They tell you, I have so many in Facebook, so many on YouTube, so many on Instagram, so many in Pinterest, and so on. And you don't know the quality, and how do you pay them based on those numbers? And in some cases, they bought a lot of those followers. And so you have to look. So there are ways. The whole marketing industry is improving that, and this year things are better actually. But they are improving the measurement of that. You don't just go by, just like for example, if you put an ad in a newspaper. They say, oh, we have a circulation of 100,000. Oh, great, that's good. So what's the reach and frequency? And you do the numbers. That's not enough, because you can put a lot of those ads in that newspaper and you don't sell one thing. And then you spend a lot less money in some little tiny newsletter.
Like a community newspapers
and,
are really good.
And you get a much better results. So the same thing with influencer marketing. There's also a blurred line between today in influencer marketing and celebrity endorsement, you know, and so sometimes we're moving toward basically going back to celebrity endorsement,
because we know they have a platform.
And then something that I've seen the last couple of years was the micro influencers, you know, people who had 1,000 or 10,000 followers, but they really matter. So as opposed to somebody with 500,000 that you don't see much, you know, they do something for you, and then you hope to get a lot of visits to your site or sales or whatever, or subscriptions, and you don't see a lot of results.
So. It's kind of like some of our Synapse events. Not a lot of people, but boy, such quality people.
Quality. Three of us were quality people.
Yeah.
I want to piggyback on what Rico was saying. In terms of influencer, for me, in the philanthropic work that I do, I'm not the face of volunteering at an ICA food shelf. I'm not the face of a church, but however, I've been able to get people my age and people of color to come to those events and come and become members and want to volunteer and do things. And that's what I feel like a true influencer is.
You're influencing like person to person, interpersonal influence.
Correct. Yes. Because right now where I volunteer at the Minnetonka ICA food shelf, the director actually is coming to me wanting to get more people of color to volunteer.
How do you do it?
Being me.
And that exactly, that qualitative element is what was missing in the equation a lot of times. So everything was quantitative. It was reach and frequency kind of thing. And so kind of a classic media formula. So the qualitative element is something that a lot of the metrics and the measurements are beginning to incorporate. And so
you have to meet someone like Victor, or a true influencer, also actually kind of a media celebrity.
Right.
I mean, if you talk about sleep and media in the Twin Cities, you're talking about Sarah Moll.
Exactly.
Right? You're a regular on WCCO television morning program.
Yes. I do have a monthly segment where I get to discuss different sleep-related topics to help our under-rested community. But as far as influencers go, I have to say, I don't necessarily think, I love the conversation between, you know, quantity and quality, even when we talk about sleep, which we can do later.
Yeah, I get a lot of sleep, but it's no good.
But that being said, I completely agree that micro-influencers or somebody with a smaller audience can have a larger impact. But I do think we have to be careful around the language that we use by saying influencers can be ineffective, because I feel like we are then excluding those micro-influencers from the conversation.
Absolutely.
And there are so many amazing, even in Minnesota alone, influencers and micro-influencers that really do amazing work in our community. For example, former guest that we have, Miss Kim Curry, who Little Miss Foodie, has a huge following. And she's even now nationally recognized because of the quality of her work, as well as we have Sarah Edwards here in the Twin Cities, who is, again, who does amazing work within our communities, connecting people. And I think it's just, it's a great conversation to have because, yes, there is that difference between quantity and quality, but by negatively speaking in any way about these influencers, we're going to exclude people who could be doing more within
Absolutely,
our society.
Absolutely, yeah. The gist of my presentation was exactly that there was a little bit of abuse. And actually, I was just quoting, like I said, CMOs mm-hmm. and heads of large agencies. And the context was not local, really, but national and global. Mm-hmm. Because they were global brands. So brands doing a lot of business in Asia, in Europe, in the Americas overall. And it was a big picture thing. And absolutely, the basic message was do it right and find ways to measure better. And
get a good influencer.
Results, high quality.
I want to talk about just briefly about micro influencers. I don't think my client is a micro influencer. She's huge. Jasmine Stringer Moore just spoke at the Becoming Michelle event last night. I styled her for that. She was a speaker on that. And she's an author. She is a philanthropic person. She's a business owner. She's all these things. She speaks at WCCO a lot, Twin Cities Live. And I style her for her segments and her appearances. And I always get the comment, how does she get to speak last night? And this is a subject for me where I'm just sort of at my limit of like, when people question why that person is there.
Oh, why are they there instead of me?
Correct. But I was like, you know, you're not paying attention to this person. If I feed you information all the time telling you, this person's on TV, this person, this is her book, Carpe Diem. She's doing all of these things. And if you're not listening to me, and then all of a sudden, bam, she's on stage with Michelle Obama. Hmm. It's the same with a lot of the work that I do. Like, if you're not paying attention to me, I'm doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes and I don't brag about it. You know, I just speak through my work. And that's what Jasmine does. And I think as an influencer, your work needs to speak, not just in numbers, your work. And this young lady does that over and over.
Well, it seems to me that the whole conversation about influencers has two components. One, people are looking for eyeballs. You're trying to reach people. And the other one is that you want them to usually buy something, go somewhere or do something or buy something, with the emphasis on buy, because that's what people are out there selling and they want eyeballs.
Right. But from a marketing perspective, though, the whole idea for me, because I have a marketing background as well, the whole idea is to make you want to do something without actually making you feel like you want to do it.
I don't even understand that.
I will tell you what to do, and you don't even realize that I'm telling you to do it. That's what marketing is. Hmm. It's very subliminal.
Boy, it's like they can hypnotize you while you're asleep.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like hypnotism.
Is that ring true, Rico Latino?
Absolutely, because you don't tell people, do this. You invite them to do it. They don't even realize, or they feel the invitation, and they go ahead. Hmm. And so results is the bottom line, really. Eyeballs is one thing, and that's part of the problem. A lot too many marketers were focusing on eyeballs. Oh, we got so many followers, so many whatever, so many, you know, a video that went viral, but then you don't sell anymore. So mm-hmm. what corporations, what is executives and CMOs, and that was what I spoke about in the conference, was what they're saying is, what are the results? What are the sales? Even long-term, brand influencing, you know, when we have a more of a brand recognition, brand awareness, people like our brand, they like us better. So the industry is evolving to come up with measurements for those things. Because one thing is, oh, we got 1,000 likes or 1,000,000 likes or 10 million follows. And something else is, are we selling any more product? Are we selling any more service?
Where are the dollars?
Yeah. So that's the bottom line. And too many marketers were just all excited about 10 million shares. And the executives are saying, so we're not selling anymore. We're looking at the numbers. Bottom line hasn't changed. So all those likes, all those shares.
It's parallel to some of those commercials that you see. Very entertaining, fascinating. And then you don't really remember what the brand is.
Right.
And you don't go out and buy this
it's
up.
Just
but it's
funny.
It's good entertainment. Yeah. It's just kind of shallow. Well, Sarah, are you getting more business because of your appearances on WCCO?
Yeah, I am. The visibility is great, and I also think that the content is as well. I enjoy sharing my knowledge of sleep, and I enjoy helping people sleep better, feel rested, and be happier. That being said, because of those feelings, when people do listen and kind of take the time to implement any tips or tricks that I give and are able to start feeling more rested and kind of have that tangible physical confirmation that I am credible, it does really lead to a lot of people trusting me and coming to me in my business. And I love that.
And part of it is that because they chose you to be on the program, it's an endorsement.
This is true. There is a lot of almost trust that comes with that. It is a huge honor. There are a number, not a huge number, but a number of sleep experts in the country. So it's still wonderful to me that they chose me to continue showing up and speaking to their audience.
You're legitimized. And plus you do a good job entertaining. So that's
well,
always
thanks,
part of
thanks,
it.
Thanks, man.
do you help Sarah with her image?
He sure does.
Yes, I do.
I was just joking. I love when my worlds collide. I've got my stylist and publicist on a podcast with me today. Awesome.
Yes, I wake up at 3:30 in the mornings on Monday for Miss Sarah Mo.
Well, see, that's the irony.
I know.
A sleep show that disrupts your sleep.
It really does.
But that's what you got to do, though. You know, I mean, that's the world of media and TV. Everything is either last minute or early. that's the way it works.
It is, yeah. That,
you know? That's the story of my life.
Yeah, but it works, though.
I mean,
there was one time, okay, forgive me for saying.
Oh, gosh.
There was one time that we were working together, and we both were really tired. And Sarah was like.
I think he's trying not to say hungover.
Oh. Well, it's good. We'll keep that secret then.
Okay. Yeah.
Edit? No, but. You know, in terms of what I do, I really help to make people feel and look their best. And Sarah looked at me one time and she's like, I look like I've had like 10 hours of sleep.
Which I didn't. Wah, wah, wah.
But that's okay. No, but when you talk about in terms of like helping her appearance, I mean, that's what my world is like. You know, I hide things, but I also enhance.
Mm-hmm.
She's a beautiful young lady here. And so my job is somewhat easy.
It's Most days. No, he really does enhance. And it's not just physical appearance. It is experience. So I think I'm honored that he chose me as a client because it is his presence that does make me better. And I think that's another thing about influencers. It's not just about them showing up and getting more numbers or getting more people involved. It's just really what they bring to the table. It's true. It's a cliche, but you're only as good as the company you keep.
And then it inspires your confidence. But also, if you think you look good, then you do a better job.
Absolutely.
Right? More confidence there.
Yep.
Wow, win, win, win. Well, we'll have to all get makeovers here before we leave the studio today. I can go down and... We're talking with actually a bunch of old, not old, but frequent Synapse attenders here today. We have Rico Latino, originally from Argentina, but he's, I guess your North American base now is Portland, Oregon, but you spent a lot of time in the Twin Cities.
Right, yeah, all over the country and always stopping in Minneapolis.
Boy, don't want to stay too long anywhere. And Victor Price, who works in the we're finding out more even as we sit. Works in the area of fashion, cultural influencer, kind of you transform people to bring out their best.
Correct.
Bang, got that one. And I'm Steve LeBeau here with Synapse Think Tank of the Air, and we'll be back right after this.
Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back with Synapse Think Tank of the Air with Rico Latino, Victor Price, and Sarah Moe. One of the big topics of Synapse and one of the things that brought us together is that the value of Synapse is to look at things from so many different perspectives because just one way of looking at things, A, it's boring, but B, it's limited because things are much more complex than we're led to believe. I mean, I use the analogy that the six blind men and the elephant, if you've ever seen me show that slide on one of my talks. Where you each, depending on where you grab the elephant, you perceive something different. The person that touches the side, well, it's like a big wall. That's the Republican. And if you grab it by the trunk, oh, no, it's like a big hose. Or the tail, no, it's like a rope. And then the one that grabs the leg, no, it's like a tree trunk. And everyone disagrees because it's a totally different perception. But if you stand back and see, well, these are just all different perspectives of the same thing. I think it's an old Buddhist parable for truth. But if you don't step back and you think yours is the correct one, then you get into a lot of clashes, a lot of difficulty. Do you? I know you had some trouble moving here from New York, Victor, that sometimes there were these clashes. And would you describe them as cultural clashes?
I would say yes. In New York, when I first moved there from D.C., I remember my first subway ride, and I'm hearing 12 different languages.
Ah.
You know, and in New York, you're forced to deal with people face on. Because we're walking on the sidewalks, they're in your face when you walk out the door. And here, like, everybody's secluded. You're in your car, you're in these skywalks, airways.
Skyways.
But, I mean, like, you're just cut off from people. So it's easy to get in your own head and just leave other people out if they're not from your environment. And in New York, we're in your face. We're like, hey, Rico, let's have a drink. Hey, you're sitting beside me. Let's hang out. I have some of my best friends from situations like that. Hmm. And I actually did encounter that with Miss Sarah Moe. That's how we met, was a situation similar to that. But it is different. It's different culturally here.
Hmm. And Rico, this is your specialty.
Sure.
Trying to, because it's one thing to, I've heard of a lot of instances where advertisers, well, this is great in, what is it, the Nova?
Oh, yeah.
In Spanish, it means doesn't go, but it's a good name for a car here in Angloland.
Right. Yeah, there are so many. I think what Victor is alluding to is actually a very clear difference in culture between either coast and the Midwest, the middle of the country. Things are different here. In fact, I heard many people who also grew up speaking another language and they're learning English. And they say, when I was in California or when I was in New York, everybody understood me. I come here and I have to repeat myself and they don't understand my accent.
Accents.
Right. Because people in the Midwest, in the middle of the country, are not as used to dealing with people who are very different from themselves and from other cultures, other countries. You go to the either coast, and especially, of course, New York, L.A., and other places. But on the coast in general, they're much more used to others. When I was in England, you can get away with murder as far as your English. You can speak English with any accent, and most people will understand you because it's a very cosmopolitan place if you go to the large cities, especially London, of course. So that's one reason. The Midwest and Minnesota and this part of the country in the middle of the continent, there is less variety, less diversity of thought, of culture, of values.
And sometimes they think you're wrong. They don't try. I mean, my wife is Japanese, so I've learned accents. And so now it seems so normal. But the more you listen to them, the easier it gets. So I guess
right.
I hang around a lot of international people because it's more fun.
Mm. Yep. On either coast, people are much more practice. They're used to all these accents.
It's very transient on the coast. You know, like you have people coming in from different countries constantly. So you are kind of forced to, like, understand and deal with it, like, quickly. I remember there were times I would be at Chopped. It's a salad shop place. And I would hear somebody in front of me trying to order their salad or their order. And the employee was like, what did you say? I was like, well, this is what she said. She said this, 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 and this. And she was speaking English, you know, but like the accent was thick, but like they're not exposed. But those experiences teach you to actually listen, like really listen to what that person is saying when they're speaking English.
In my defense, Minnesotans aren't all that way.
Okay.
They're not all that way.
No, not all.
Yeah, your accents are fine, but.
We do get a bad rap here in the Midwest, and I do understand that the majority of, you know, people who don't have experience with other cultures do act a certain way. But Minneapolis especially, and a lot of the Minnesotans who are born and raised, really do make an effort to to involve themselves in those kinds of things. I myself am biracial. My dad is black and my mom is white. I grew up in two very different kinds of families. And I understand that dichotomy can lead to questions. And I do think there is a natural curiosity, especially in the Midwest, with the majority of us having Swedish ancestors. But we do get a bad rap, but there's always a percentage of people who really do kind of defy the stereotype.
Absolutely. And you're one of them.
Yeah.
You're
one. Exactly. Absolutely. Yes.
And well, Steve, are you from this area, Steve?
Well, actually, I was served in the military as a child.
Okay.
So I was born in Minnesota, but it's only because it was the closest hospital to Stockholm, Wisconsin, because the river was frozen over. You could drive across. So I was born in Minnesota, but then my father was in the Marine Corps. Oh. So, like I say, I was drafted at an early age and served until I was 13. That's when I got out.
Wow.
So, and then I came back here, yeah, for the most part.
That makes three of us. I'm a Navy brat.
Oh, really?
From Argentina. Yeah.
Wow. So, have you ever been in the service?
Not yet, but I feel like I should now. Come on. I've dated a couple, but that's where it stops.
That's close enough, probably. Yep. Boy. Then, and another part of it is the not only there's kind of an accent gap between Minnesotans and everybody else in the world, we have our own accent. It's in the movie Fargo.
No.
Came across pretty well.
No,
no,
we don't.
Hey, there's a boat.
Hey.
But also the racial gap. I mean, that's one thing we talk about too in Synapse quite a bit. The friendship gap. 82% of the whites in the Midwest do not know anybody but other white people. So that is kind of a blanket of ignorance too that keeps people disconnected.
I think that one element of that is that it changes depending on your age. You can say over 60, 40 to 60, 30 to 40, under 30, you know. And that can change drastically because you look at a lot of young people today and their friends are very, very diverse. And the fact that the population itself, you know, for example, Hispanics, Latinos, can be 10%, 5% of Minnesota or whatever state or the whole 13, 17% in the whole country. But when you look at populations of grade school kids, you know, up to age 12 and under, maybe it's a quarter or 30% Hispanic. And the number is a little lower, but still significant if you look at under 18. So the younger you skew the population, the more diverse people's friendships can be.
Yeah, a lot of attitudes change too with age.
Well, I found it interesting here in the Twin Cities when I go out to eat and I have a little kid that's like 3 or 4 and they're just like gawking at me. They're just, oh. And what that tells me, I'm like, in the demographic that you're talking about, that lets me know, I'm like, that kid has no friends or their parents don't have any friends that are people of color. Because if you're looking at me like that, I know I'm interesting looking. But, like, it's not...
Because you're your own image maker.
Correct.
But they stare.
They stare. Yeah. And I'm like, if that child was exposed to people of color already through their parents or through their school, that wouldn't be that shocking to the child, is my point.
Hmm.
I'm used to it now. I find it entertaining, to be quite honest.
Well, there are many of us who like to stare at you.
There's all many reasons for staring then, Victor. And that's one of the problems I have too with a lot of private schools. If you go to a public school in Minneapolis and St. Paul, the majorities have been students of color for a long time now. But if you move to the suburbs or go to a private school, that greatly decreases the number of people of color you're going to run into. So it's, you know, they might get better grades, might be, you know, some advantages of it. But boy, I have to worry about it.
I did the same for my son. He is 6 in first grade, and having to worry about what it is you want from the education is something that's very transparent in Minnesota. You have to physically decide what's more important for my child to be in a diverse environment and learn the social and human skills to become the kind of great person that I want them to be, or get good grades and hopefully setting them on a trajectory of ending up at Yale. You know, it's something that...
Without you having to bribe the people to get in there.
Well, don't even get me started. but I think that, you know, as parents, that's something that absolutely should be on the table as far as things that you consider. I think it obviously is more present in my mind as somebody who is biracial. I don't want my son in an environment where he is either the only one of something or is surrounded by, you know, a completely strict environment of feeling other, but at the same time, having that balance of a great education and a great education is in a school system or, you know, kind of brain scale versus emotional or human scale. It's, I don't know, it's just always a balance if you're lucky enough to have those choices.
Hmm. Another one of these gaps is the perception of racism. And I can tell you, I've been around a lot of whites in my life. Being a white, just tiny percent of me is non-white, but it's pretty minuscule. And they don't see racism. They just don't see it, even though they can be doing it. And I've been in newsroom discussions where everyone's white and they say things, it's like, ouch, you know, they don't say that. And then you can tell, think of how many decisions they make based on their ignorance. But then when I've been involved in different sorts of things with people of color. Of course, I'm married to an Asian woman. You see a lots of things. I mean, and then you hear even more because when I'm not there, it's like the quantum paradox. If you're looking, it changes it. If I'm not there and I hear, for example, the little kids. When my daughter was two or three at the library with my wife, and there's another little kid, and they start kind of engaging. And the mother grabs her away. Nope, don't you play with that girl. She's not one of us. And then on and on and on. So you get to see by knowing other people and you have them talk about what they've experienced. That's the value of the multi-perspective setting there, the perspectivism. You can see things that you wouldn't ordinarily see by learning through other people's experience.
That's right. That's part of the process of acquiring cultural competence. And all of us are in a continuum becoming, hopefully, all of us becoming more culturally competent as we go through life. Hopefully, I'm more culturally competent today than I was yesterday or last year. So all of us, it's not that you're an expert or anything. And part of cultural competence and organizations such as the Peace Corps and other international organizations that send people overseas, if you work for 3M and you're sent overseas to work in Europe or Asia, Latin America, you typically have pretty good training. Part of that training is to be able to see your own culture with somebody through somebody else's lens, through somebody else's life. One case that I you know, as I traveled through the world across my life, I've always been part of some kind of an expat group in Europe, in Latin America, and in some parts of Africa. And the expat groups are interesting because you have people from all over the world who live in a different place. And so we have a lot in common. And one mark, sometimes you see people in culture shock. And for example, in Paris, you hear a joke about Americans, and you're an American, and you get offended. Yet another American laughs their head off because they see the humor in it. Mm-hmm. So you don't get offended because you are able to see your culture through somebody else's eyes. Same thing in Argentina. I traveling throughout Latin America extensively over the years, I've heard so many Argentine jokes. They have jokes about Argentines. I thought they're hilarious. I went back to Argentina. The first time I really went back and spent some time, I would tell these jokes to my family. And it's like, well, you know, that's not fair because of... And they didn't... It's like, okay, I better be quiet. I guess these jokes are not to be told in Argentina. Because if you're an Argentine, if you're anywhere in the world and you are in your own country and maybe you travel internationally as a tourist and come back, you may not have the level of cultural competence, the level of being able to laugh at your own culture. And that is one milestone, to be able to see your own culture through somebody else's eyes, maybe different people's eyes, what Asians think of Americans in general, what Europeans, what whatever. And the stereotypes have a reason for being, you know, and they have a grain of truth. Some of them, sometimes it's funny. I like to talk about Europe in heaven and hell, you know, and that really rings true. Just very briefly, okay, you're not aware.
You have a joke for us?
Well, it's actually a truth.
I have one too.
Some truthful. Okay, good. This is quick. In heaven, in heaven, all the cooks are French. All the mechanics are German. All the police are English. The lovers are Italian. And the Swiss make everything run on time. In hell, the cooks are English, the police are German, the mechanics are French, the Swiss are the lovers, and the Italians make everything run on time. All those stereotypes ring true, and it's funny because, not only Italians are that way, they can be on time, but, you know,
if cultures... If you think of a late train, well, I heard of a similar... We'll get to yours next, I did a project for... it was for Medtronic. Mm. And as we took a break, and one of the guys there is telling us they recently had an international conference, people brought in from all over the world, you know, that worked in their different remote offices. And the bus was there to pick them up at 8 o'clock. He said, well, the German was there at 7:30. The American and the Japanese got there right at 8. About 8:30, the Frenchman came. The Italian came at 9, and I think it was someone from Latin America came there like 10.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So another one of this is supposedly a real anecdote.
The time orientation, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, in terms of like culture and things of that nature and speaking different languages, I frequent France a lot, and a lot of my friends are like, do you speak French? And I was like, no, I'm Victor. I mean, I speak un petit français. You know, but the last time I was there, I needed my hair cut, and it was our last day in Paris. And my husband was like, Victor, you're not going to get your hair cut in Notre Dame. I was like, do you know who you're married to? And so we go through, because we're going to this restaurant, our favorite restaurant, Le Petit Prince. And I see coiffeur, which I know is hair. So I walk in, and I see this lady with one eye going this way and one eye going that way.
Uh-oh.
No, it was great. It was the best haircut of my life. And I look at her. It was a bonjour, mademoiselle. I was like, I just grunt. In a French way. Yeah. Okay. But you got to go, like that. And so she's like, oui, oui. And she like motions me to sit down. She cuts my hair into a mohawk.
Mm.
And she goes, voila. And I was like, oh, she's got jokes. I was like, okay. But I looked at that as a moment to really bond with her, because I could have been either really upset or look at this moment to laugh and bond. So I look at her and I go, oh, a la Grace Jones. And she's like, oh, me. And she takes out a straight edge razor and cuts the rest of my hair.
Wow.
Nobody in the States does that to my head. I like my hair like bald, like clean.
That's the way to do it.
Yes. And so at the end, she looks at me and she takes her phone to my husband. And she goes, selfie? And he's like, oh, you want a picture of me? She's like, no. Him, meaning me.
Uh-huh.
And it was just wonderful. But like, I have these kind of experiences overseas a lot where I'm just like, I don't speak their language, but they actually are able to communicate with me. So my question is sometimes in the States in terms of cultural diversity and racism, I'm like, we speak the same language. So why can we not understand each other?
Hmm.
That's my point of saying all of that.
You can get along with the French woman that you don't speak the same language, but you can't get along with other Anglos.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, that's a problem.
Okay. Let's think about that problem for a moment, and we'll take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back. I'm Steve LeBeau with Synapse Think Tank of the Air. We have some thinkers with us today, some old-time Synapse thinkers. Rico Latino, Victor Price, and Sarah Moe. Sarah was sleep health specialist. She is a specialist. We have Victor Price is a fashion and cultural influencer, and Rico Latino is a Hispanic marketing and multicultural expert. You know all this stuff. And one of the things going on these days is people are making, things are slipping up in their history that they're racist. Okay, you have the governor of Virginia has a racist thing in his yearbook from when he was in school. And now you have, they changed the name of Lake Calhoun because they found out Calhoun was a slaveholder. And now they're looking at a couple buildings at the University of Minnesota, Kauffman Hall, among others, saying, well, these guys advocated racial segregation in campus dorms. We don't want their names. Well, Rico, you were talking about this continuum of cultural competency. And I've always kind of been a believer that education means that people can change. So to what extent can people change and kind of get beyond that? And how do you know it? How do you know if they've achieved adequate competence to be honored once again?
Right. Part of what we're talking about here is how culture changes. Culture is always changing. I can show you ads. In one of my latest presentations, I show ads from the 50s and 60s. And they are for tobacco. There are children present, a little baby telling his mom or her mom about how cool she looks when she smokes this brand. One is a doctor saying the brand that doctors smoke the most or something like that. Uh-huh. And so cigarettes and then the sexism involved, what a good wife is and the roles of men and women, gender roles. Culture has changed drastically. If we were to, you know, you wouldn't be able to run any of those ads, TV, radio, print, today.
You'd be boycotted.
Right, you're boycotted, you're out of business. So culture is always changing. And so what was okay at one point, today we say, oh, no, that doesn't cut it. We want to change. In terms of assessing cultural competence, one definition, one way I like to define cultural competence is the ability to effectively communicate with and work with somebody who is very different from me, from you, from each one of us. And so it could be it doesn't have to go across racial or ethnic lines. It could be age. It could be anything, personality, personal style. It could be my twin brother. We grew up together, went to the same school, same ethnicity, obviously, and we're so different personality-wise that we just can't have a good conversation together. We cannot work together, definitely. And so communication can be improved. So cultural competence is understanding the differences between two people or a group of people in many different areas and being able to effectively communicate with and work with them.
So so you said a couple things there. One, it's you have to look at the historical context. I mean, way back when, these things were normal. So how much do you put on a person's shoulders or how much do you blame them if something was so-called normal? Well, they should have known better. And then you also said that pretty broadly, it doesn't need to be a racial barrier or a linguistic barrier. It could just be, you know, your brother's a total nerd and you're not into statistics, something like that. Well, I see you look pensive there. Victor, do you have comments on all this?
I do.
Can people change?
People can change, but as a person of color, as a black man, I don't get the ability to say I'm sorry for any mistakes that I make. I always have to be on point, no mistakes. Otherwise, I'm punished for the rest of my life. I don't get that chance to erase my mistakes. So that's why I'm pensive. I walk on pins and needles every day, and I'm fine with my life, my lifestyle, and what I do. But I don't get a chance to make the mistakes that we are seeing today, that people, politicians, mothers, celebrities doing every day. And then to come back and apologize, I don't get to apologize for anything that I do.
So it's a double standard or maybe
it's a complete double standard.
Quadruple.
And I don't agree with that. So if somebody is calling those people out for things they did in the past, I'm like, finally, somebody said something. You know, I mean, things I've done in my past, like to get me to this place where you started the conversation in the first place, people still hold that against me till this day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still that little boy from the military that moved to D.C. and worked two jobs to make things work for myself with no support from my family. And, you know, not everybody agreed with some of my jobs. That's fine. But guess what? I wasn't calling home to mommy and daddy getting them to bribe me to get into school either.
You neither? Well, that makes four
I'm
of
just
us
saying. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
You earned your way and worked
correct.
Hard. And why should you change your standard, the standard that was applied toward you.
Correct.
To somebody else? Why give them a break?
It's like I was told, like, you have to be this, you have to be that. Your grades have to be this. You have to go to this school. Mm. You have to be polished, prim, and proper at all times. And I was like, so why do you get to walk around like this? So that's why I'm pensive, because I don't get a chance to relax.
Mm. Sarah?
That's true.
Oh, I think that's 100% obvious. People of color have a completely different standard in this country. Racism is ingrained in who we are, and it's ingrained in our education system, in our government. It's just a part of our country. I remember as a biracial woman, my dad's black, my mom's white, and my ex-husband is very white from Iowa.
You can't get more white than that.
You can't get more white. And when I was pregnant with my son, I remember thinking, as far as genetics goes, he could look any way.
Right.
He could be this, he could be that, he could be short, he could be tall, he could be black, he could be white, he could be blue-eyed and in between. As my grandma always said, there are no lifeguards in the gene pool. And when I had him, I remember thinking, I felt grateful that he looked white.
Hmm.
And I hated that I had to feel grateful that he would not ever be known. If you looked at him, you would never know he was 25% black.
Hmm.
And that just is the state of our country, that as a person of color, you are going to get, sorry for my language, but the shit under the stick.
Hmm.
And it's not changing fast enough. We've been in a civil rights movement since we've been in it, and it's still happening. It's just not, it really isn't fair. And as a person of color who also gets confused as Asian or Latino, or who frequently has people come up and speak different languages to her because nobody knows what I am, I do also have those moments of feeling fortunate that people don't know I'm a black woman.
Well, Sarah, I want to flip that on the other side, because some of the things that I get because of the things that I do and how I live my life from Caucasian people, white people, what have you, I have counterparts that are just like, well, why do you get to do that? And I'm like, I'm sorry. I didn't grow up like you. Like, I'm not privileged. So if I'm here doing X, Y, and Z, and my life is a little bit better than yours, don't look at me as the problem. I was like, you should look at yourself and say, why didn't you work harder?
Hmm.
And not rest on the backbone of just being that, you know? And I know that sounds harsh, but again, I don't get the opportunity to rest or relax. I always have to keep pushing to be better and to do more. So if I'm doing more and living my best life, I'm like, why can't you just be happy for me? Hmm. Like, this system was not set up for people like me to succeed. And the fact that I am doing that, why are you mad? That's a big question. I don't know. Does anybody else think that?
Well, I was thinking of the, it's a very politically incorrect name of a poem by Rudyard Kipling, The White Man's Burden.
Have you heard that? Yes.
And so the story then, this was like the turn of the 19th century, when pretty much the whole world outside of Europe was a colony. And so it's like, oh, there's all these people. They're not white. They're not Christian. It's our duty to raise them into civilization and to show them the right way to God and all that stuff. And so that's the white man's burden, you know, because they can't do it themselves. And it seems to me now there's a new white man's burden, because when you talk about racism, it's caused by white people. The victims are not white people. If you talk about sexism, it's perpetrated by men, not women. So it's like, it should be the white man's burden to try to undo all this stuff that's been done over the last X number of centuries.
Mm-hmm.
It should be, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean...
we're getting there.
But that's the burden, because now they have these books on white fragility and stuff.
White fragility, you know, oh, poor us, we can't grab ass anymore without being told that we're you can't. That's just it was never right in the first place. It's just that now people are more educated,
and they brush it off as saying, oh, that's, you want me to be politically correct, huh?
Yes. Oh, everybody's so PC, poor me. But I think that it is important to acknowledge how far so many have come, so many perpetrators of these things that we are no longer willing to accept. I do think it's changing, and it's changing quickly. I also think that there are always going to be the people who were raised in this, and this is their life. This is their innate way of being, and that's understandable. But I do also feel like, as we were talking about earlier, people can change. I don't think that if you're, you know, an old racist white dude that you will be forever. I think it is possible to have relationships and conversations to make you understand that it's just lack of education or experiences that cause you to think something that's wrong. But I do love that the conversation is even happening that give people the chance to change. I saw this story on CNN a few weeks ago about a man. He was a white supremacist. He was part of a white supremacist group. His entire body tattooed in Nazi symbols and such, and shouted from the rooftops that, you know, white was the best, superior race, and ended up getting into trouble and going to jail and was assigned a black female parole officer.
Oops.
Who changed his entire life after his relationship with her and her care for him, despite the fact that she knew his background or his beliefs. She cared for him and wanted the best for him and to get him on a better path. And the point of the show was that he went to get his tattoos removed and really ended up showing up at her house with flowers to thank her for being herself and not judging him. So he was allowed to get to know her and know that he was wrong about his opinions of people of color because he had never known one.
Hmm.
So it's
possible.
It's possible. And I believe it. Maybe it's because I'm Minnesotan, but I believe it can happen for anyone.
Absolutely. Yes. There are stories about people, for example, who have a very, sometimes coming from religion, but a very anti-gay stance in life. And then one of their children comes out as gay.
Mm.
And they change and they understand and they're open and inclusive. And so personal experiences can dramatically revolutionize like this, you know, your life.
Absolutely.
So getting back to the very beginning of our conversation, that parole officer was a micro-influencer.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's yes. Right.
So this personal connection, that might be the key. I mean, that's getting back, that's kind of like a commercial for Synapse. That's our idea, is to get people together across these boundaries.
Well, I just want to touch on something really quick. I always have stories, you know, that everybody does.
That's why you're here.
But, I mean, in terms of racism, though, my own husband, when Black Panther came out, I became really obsessed with Afrofuturism.
Mm.
And it's something I've been doing my entire life, but I didn't know I was doing it until the movie came out. And I just, something was burning inside of me, like just really burning. And I'm like, my husband doesn't understand me. He's an older white man. And then like, he just doesn't understand. He thinks I'm always angry or I think everybody's out to get me. And I'm like, look, these are facts. These are things that are going on right now. And I found this article about feminism from an African-American lady. And I was in my bed at 1:30 in the morning crying, reading this article. And I sent it to him right there, sent it in his email. The next morning he wakes up and he's like, Victor, I'm so sorry. I'm a racist. I was like, I know.
That's your nice little breakfast talk.
Right.
I love you too.
Right? I was like, I just want you to understand that. I said, I don't have anything against white people. I was like, I married you. I was like, I don't have anything against white people, but I need you to understand where I'm coming from. When I'm afraid to drive at night, when I'm afraid of this, or I know that somebody's talking to me in an ill will, know that like I'm not making it up, and like they'll say it to me before they'll say it to you.
Mm.
And I was like, you need to look at the people that surround you. I said, because I'm your husband. And since I've moved here, like people will talk at me in certain ways where I'm like, when I say who my husband is, and they're like, oh. And I was like, it's too late.
Mm.
You made a bad move already. Mm. I was like, do I look like I just fell out of the sky into Minnesota? No, I don't. I'm here for a reason. You know, I'm not just your regular Joe Blow. And so when I explain that to people, they just can't understand or fathom that like people would speak to me in that manner. I said, but it's because as I was thinking about philanthropic things, I was like, I'm not your typical face for many things. And people underestimate what I'm actually capable of constantly. And when you actually present them with the facts and your degrees, your experience levels and things of that nature, that whole topic and that demeanor changes drastically. And sometimes it intimidates people. I don't care. But I'm just like, you know, it is what it is. I just don't like to be talked down to, is my point.
And that's what people have. Well, that's what stereotypes are. They set up expectations for what is this person going to be like? Well, let's see. And your mind automatically sifts through everything you saw in a movie or on TV. But if you've never met anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, I had a patient. I worked overnights doing sleep studies, diagnosing sleep disorders. And I had an older white male patient. And I got his wires on. We talked about his sleep, getting him ready for bed, and he said, "You are the nicest colored girl I've ever met." And I put my hand on his shoulder and I said, "Thank you." And I put him to bed. To him, that was a compliment. And I understand that it was not intended as an insult.
I would have said, "You're a nice white guy."
Well, you're not bad for a white guy.
Healthcare is tricky that way. Right. But, you know, I think intentionally, his intentions were good. And that's what I had to take away from that experience. Yeah. But I'll definitely never forget it. And it always does teach you a lesson in generational differences and how people speak to you.
Yes. Mm. Sarah, wait a minute. I'm sorry. Same thing happened to me in West Virginia. The first time I went to Lost River, West Virginia, and I looked at my friends, they had a cabin, and I was like, "I'm not going to West Virginia." I was like, "Oh God." I was like, "I'm going to get hung. I don't know. Like, it's West Virginia." I was stereotyping those
people.
I was like, "I'm going to stay at the cabin with y'all. Like, congratulations on building it." But we went to the resort at the bottom of the hill, and the owner of the resort came up to me. He's like, "Oh, you look like one of the boys in my picture book, my Sears Roebuck catalog." And I was like, "Oh God." I was like, "Oh God." And he was gay, but he's going back that far. I don't even know what a Sears Roebuck catalog looks like. So I guess I look like some little black boy in a cowboy hat or something. I don't know. I mean, I did have on a cowboy hat, but I don't know what that boy looked like.
Well, you look like a model. That's what he's saying. You know, someone that put on, you know, demonstrated in clothing.
Yeah.
Gosh. So was that a compliment?
It was a compliment. Yeah, it was a compliment.
Wow.
Talking about stereotypes, you know, West Virginia is well known for being a place of creativity and innovation. In fact, that's where the toothbrush was invented. You know how we know that? Well, it would have been called the teeth brush. Talking about stereotypes. Okay. Sorry, West Virginians.
Okay, I just got word. This program has been canceled. No, it's, no, we're out of time. That's what it is. No boycott here. Well, this has been interesting. I think we could keep going on with stories for quite a long time, but we're out of time here at Synapse, the think tank of the air. And so think about all that stuff for a while. I want to thank you so much, Victor Price, Rico Latino, and Sarah Moe. Thanks for joining us. I'd also like to thank Dan Culhane, our producer, and mention that this is a co-production with WCCO Radio. I'm Steve LeBeau. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.